grateful to have him in the CTBB Discord. Like he's been dropping crazy stuff. And he said next time he's like, oh man, next time I find something like this, I'm not going to post it on Twitter. I'm just going to put it in the cool research channel on the CTBB Discord. I'm like, yes!
Yeah, you should have done that. Yeah.
What's up, hackers? Welcome to the This Week in Bug Bounty segment, where we talk about hackers that are rocking it, programs that are rocking it, and cool opportunities for you, the listener. So let's jump right into it. First one up this week is actually a write-up about yours truly from Bug Crowd, the hacker spotlight for RhinoReader. So if you want to get to know me a little bit better, then this write-up contains a lot of the information that we kind of skim over on the pod. So definitely check it out if you're up for that. But the real update here was that a new program launched on Bug Crowd, which is called Ultra Mobile. Now, you know, new programs pop up all the time. We try to keep you up to date on that. But this one's specifically interesting because Ultra Mobile is not what it sounds like, or at least it's not what I thought it was in the first place. It's actually Mint Mobile. Yeah, that's right. The one that with all the crazy commercials with Ryan Reynolds and that sort of thing. So we always talk about hack on brands that you're excited about or that you're, you know, that you use. And I think this is a great opportunity to do that. This one just went public not too long ago. This specific program is for their mobile scope, but they also have web scope that is in scope of another public program. So definitely check them out if you're interested in hacking on Mint Mobile, and then you can tell your friends you hacked Ryan Reynolds or whatever. All right. On the similar vein of good programs, I also wanted to highlight John Deere. Okay. A lot of people, Rezo included, the co-host of the podcast, have had a tremendous experience on the John Deere program. They are public about the fact that they have a private program. Here's a write-up right here on their website that talks about how they paid $1.5 million through their private program. But they also have a VDP. So this is a good opportunity for you guys that kind of want to jump the queue here and hack on a program or a VDP that will get you access to a BBP, then this could be a good opportunity to do that. The reviews have been amazing. The team sounds awesome. So definitely check that out if you're interested. All right. And last up, we have from Yes We Hack, the Yes We Hack Dojo. Now, if you guys haven't checked out the Yes We Hack Dojo, I have to admit, I was kind of sleeping on it a little bit too. But these are like pretty technical challenges that they're putting out every week that really help you understand some pretty core technologies. And this week they've launched one called Ruby Treasure. I won't give up too much information about it, but it's definitely worth checking out if you want to try to hack Ruby related targets. All right, that's all we got for the This Week in Bug Bounty segment. Let's go back to the show. All right, man, I guess we kind of owe the listeners an apology, right? Because we've had this Google podcast stuck in approval hell for what, three weeks
three
now?
3 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, dude. So guys, I promise it's coming. It is coming, and it's a good ass episode. Don't you think, man?
It is. Yeah, it really is. It's both fun, entertaining, and extremely informative and really long too. So
lots of good insights. I think it's like 2-something hours. We interview one of the Google employees, get some of his cool war stories, and then we also spend a long time sort of debriefing the dubs over there in Tokyo.
And for that Google Life hack let me just say for everyone, it's not for lack of trying. Justin is a very persistent hounder of people, so and he cares very deeply about getting this stuff out. So just so you all know, we're fighting on your behalf. Yeah.
Yeah, I really do. And I I'm not going to say I made an enemy, at Google, but their PR person definitely I'm sure is not pleased with me because I'm like, hey, when is it approved? When is it approved? And to be honest, at the end of the day, they're doing their best to get it approved. And and I know their team is, there's just a lot of logistic stuff that's come up, but be patient with us. It is coming and hopefully it'll be out the week after this episode is out. So that's what they've committed to this time. So hopefully that'll actually happen. All right, man, we have a lot of stuff to get to and only about an hour, maybe even less to get to it. So let's jump right in. The biggest news I think of this week is this Lonzer zero day in Chrome.
Yeah, you went deep on this so much so that you were like not replying to things and you were like looking into it and you started a whole little hack along thing. So tell me about it.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the deal. So we're recording this episode. Thank you, our production team. Sorry, I know this is going out late, but we're recording this episode on May 7th. On May 5th at 1 p.m., Lonzer tweeted something out and then proceeded to drop the tweet in the Cool Research channel in our Discord saying, hey, check out this technique. And essentially what this allows the attacker to do is if you have an image injection on any page loading from your attacker-controlled server, you can leak the query parameters of the page where that image is injected to the attacker-controlled server.
So when you say image injection, do you mean you have to like be able to inject the image tag or literally just by being able to inject a URL there?
It could be anything. Like I think Jorian, Demo, a couple other people from the Discord did a little like follow-up on this afterwards, mm-hmm. myself as well. And they found out that this technique applies to, you know, say you're injecting in the source of an image tag, mm-hmm. That's loaded on the page. It could be a dynamically generated image tag. It could be CSS background URL. It could be anything essentially that loads an image.
All you need is that injection point. You don't have to be able to put in the tag. You just need literally the URL.
Just control the source.
Wow.
Right. Which is super common.
Yeah. So common.
Yeah. And it used to be that this was the default, right? When the referrer would just, yeet out the full, location.href to whatever server it connected to. But then a couple of years back, they said, actually, we're just going to put the origin in the referrer header. But the way that Lonzer does this, and I'll go ahead and share my screen here, is he responds with a header. Here it is right here. He responds with a link header in the response of that image. Now, this link header is then processed by the browser. And unfortunately, in that link header, you can set the referrer policy, right? Which controls what data is sent in the referrer. And it also allows to specify a preload, right? And essentially what this does then is when they load the URL that's returned in that link header, it leaks the full location.href to the preload request that's being defined in the link header because of that unsafe URL referrer policy specified.
So
really cool stuff.
Mm-hmm. Are link headers pretty common? I mean, obviously I've been hacking for a while and I don't see them very often I haven't like heard much about them. So is this like a common known thing?
No, it's not. I mean, this, and unfortunately I kind of stuck my foot in my mouth a little bit here. Let me see if I can
immediately tag the person to fix it. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. I immediately tagged Jun Kolkatsu from Google and he's like, why did you tag me in this? I will fix this immediately.
Yeah.
I'm like, shit, I shouldn't have done that. So it works out in the end, it works out because I think Lonzer, he had been trying to get this acknowledged by the Google team and hey, you should not load link headers on sub resources of pages.
Yeah.
Because that's not a good idea. And Google was like, fine. It's not that big of a deal. But then when it gets a bunch of PR via this tweet, then I think they're looking to make a change now. But as a lot of people in the community said, it's going to be a long deprecation period.
Why is that?
You know,
just because like all their stuff that rolls out could have downstream effects and they just need to make sure they don't break support for like enterprise clients and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think also, it's a the link header, despite, this specific scenario probably being a little bit more difficult or more nuanced, the link header is used. So June unfortunately also killed the Japanese character set thing that people have been using to get XSS, and that one was a little bit easier to deprecate because of the fact that nobody's using that.
But the
character set sniffing, and this one I think is going to be a little bit different. I think we've got at least a year.
Oh wow, that's
we
a
can
long
exploit
time.
This. I do. That's my professional guess.
Yeah.
But if June has anything to say about it, it might be faster.
Yeah. That's sweet.
Yeah. And the other thing I wanted to shout out on this dude. Okay. Well. Okay. So there's like five tweets that go along with this. Okay.
Yep.
So, here's the tweet that I did, sort of as a recap of this whole thing, because this really is game changing, right?
Yeah.
Like this completely removes. a security boundary that's been in place for years. So the first thing that I kind of wanted to, that I specified in the summary of this vulnerability was that this can be done recursively with multiple links. So you can say, okay, provide the link header with a preload URL, and then provide another one with a preload URL. And then those preloads can also return the link headers.
Okay.
Right? Yep. And so essentially you can do it recursively over and over and over again and mm-hmm. create a consistent stream of requests coming from the user's browser with a single image source load.
Wow.
Isn't that like sick?
Yeah, but I guess what's the benefit to just doing it the once? Like why would, give me some attack scenarios.
Yeah, so I mean, just the once is good enough to leak the referrer. But if you want to do it time and time again, there's a couple things that could apply to. One, you can, because prefetches are set with are sending cookies with them.
Yep.
You could do a zero click get based CSERF exploitation if you have an image injection that would be.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. And it also enables it if you have to brute force an ID. So let's say, for example, I've got a get base CSERF, but I need a numeric ID and I know it's going to take like 200 requests to do it. Right. I could use this to like do a bunch of requests from the victim's browser and trigger that get base CSERF potentially with zero click by getting just an image injection on the like user's dashboard or something.
Wow. Yeah. Honestly,
does that make sense?
I really hope somebody pulls that off. That is sick.
Yeah. Yeah,
so that's really cool,
so that's one of them. Very cool stuff. The second one was this, which was really interesting. We also have access to setting media queries here, which is also an attribute of the link tag. So we can specify almost like CSS-like syntax that will be run in the victim's environment just by loading a tag. Unfortunately, media queries are pretty limited at this point. Pretty much the only useful thing we can leak is like the viewport size, which can tell us whether we're like in an iframe mm-hmm. or whatever, but it could be useful for cross-site leaks. I definitely would imagine that this will pop up in a CTF at some point.
Yeah.
But I think there's definitely additional impact there. And then the third one here is that prefetch, which is the one that is being used here, isn't the only rel directive in the link header that can be used here. So there's also other ones like compression dictionary, module preload, and preload. And the one that's really interesting here is compression dictionary, because what that allows you to do is force the browser to download a dictionary that is then used to decompress following requests being made.
Okay.
So you can like modify the contents of those requests. But I played around with it for a little while, and I just can't get it to do anything super interesting.
Yeah.
So that's
where my mind went immediately when you mm-hmm. showed me that unsafe URL part. It's like yeah. that those like little parameters that are mm-hmm. a part of the link header, like what yeah. all options do you have there that you could set that could potentially do other things that are malicious?
Yeah. So I like went down the rabbit hole on that. There's a couple that look really, really promising. Like you can set the you can hint at a content type, but it's not the content type they actually use. It's just the one that the browser actually like is hinted at. So it knows when to load this. You can give it priority. You can say this is a high priority request or a low priority request, which you might be able to do something with that. But yeah. And then last but not least, as I mentioned before, this works with any type of image injection, pretty much. You could be HTML image tag, could be dynamically generated images,
wow.
could be CSS background images, could be font face sources even. Mm-hmm. So there's like, this is also super impactful to CSS injection
mm-hmm.
Because previously CSS injection didn't have a way to leak the query parameters. And now we do. So pretty sick stuff. As far as remediation goes, there is pretty much not a great way to remediate this. Only options you have are a strict CSP image source to prevent the attacker from getting the image injection in the first place, or a strict default source, which is even harder to implement to prevent the prefetch request from going through.
So is there any way for a web app developer to develop safely a web app that can use user selected URLs for pulling in images, or no?
Man, I'm trying to think about it.
Server side, they're going to have to like download it and then host it themselves, right? So that then they can set that safe domain to pull from.
Maybe like a, maybe they have to use one of those like image proxies or something like that, right?
Could they drop the link header? Are they able to do that?
Not if they're not,
because it's the browser's doing it, not the code, right?
Service worker. I don't know, man. It's pretty rough. I mean, the best bet right now is to just make sure that if you're loading user supplied images on the page, you should proxy it through something like, you know, one of those /image/, and then you put the URL in the path, which is
that's just a tough fix. That's a pretty like heavy lift for a lot of companies, especially I feel like honestly, the majority of companies that have user supplied links to URLs and stuff, they're like smaller companies or like SMBs or, you know, like that sort of thing. Cause I feel like whenever you're at a huge enterprise scale, you do have some sort of link proxy or like caching or downloading it. And so, man, that's going to be a tough fix for companies. And it's like so impactful too. I wonder if the community comes up with a good remediation, definitely share it with us. Cause I think people could throw that in their reports as a really great way to show impact. Like, hey, here's your one-click ATO. Here's your thing you can implement to fix it.
Yeah. I wonder if you, man, I want to say, I was thinking like, I wonder if you could just set the referrer policy directly on the image, but I think it doesn't respect it because the link header that's getting injected is the thing that is, so nuts, kind of crazy. But anyway, the last thing I wanted to say on all that was I have three different
exploitations.
People tweeting out here saying like, yep, just got one click ATO via this. Yep, got one click ATO. Yep, got one click ATO. So people are milking this already. And to be clear, you know, this isn't a vulnerability in and of itself. Like you have to land an OAuth code on the page where that image is injected, right? And that's how you leak it via an unconsumed OAuth code. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how you get it to not be consumed, and then you leak it out by the referrer, and that's how you get ATO. So
could you link other sensitive things besides OAuth codes though? There's probably a lot of setups where there are other interesting things that can be linked or leaked.
Yeah. You know, where the user controls the return URL. I mean, I haven't seen it a lot, but I mean, it's definitely out there, but props to these people. I mean, I don't know if they just like jumped on it and were like, got lucky, or if they knew in advance.
They
like,
probably
I remember
knew.
Seeing this.
Yeah. Or they had good notes. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's everything. You know, Slonzer has been releasing some really good stuff, and I feel super grateful to have him in the CTBB Discord. Like he's been dropping crazy stuff. And he said next time he's like, oh man, next time I find something like this, I'm not going to post it on Twitter. I'm just going to put it in the cool research channel on the CTBB Discord. I'm like, yes.
Yeah, you should have done that. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, man, what you got?
So we're going to both kind of go down the list. I would say the first thing, which is maybe like one of the really cool write-ups, it's on Medium. Mm-hmm. Sharon Brizenoff, if you want to.
He came on the pod. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If he should post on something else besides Medium. I'm so passionate about people having their own blogs, like, you know, get your own stuff, you know, like just like get your own credit for it, you know, build your own brand for it. But anyways, I actually didn't know he was on the podcast. So
He came on before. I think that was in that transition period back in November. So,
okay. Yeah, cool.
It was an awesome episode though, man. I mean, like he is phenomenal.
Okay. I will definitely go back and listen to it. Yeah. This to me is like the classic bug hunter path towards finding a bunch of vulnerabilities. Let me see if I can share it real quick while I'm talking for the listeners. Share screen. Okay. Yeah, here we go. So how I made 64K from deleted files, a bug bounty story. It wouldn't surprise me if there's still lots of reports out there pending on this, but basically he did what many people have done, which is, you know, try to search for secrets in GitHub repos. But the way he did it was at like a very large scale and also using very smart, deep kind of Git techniques. So you can look into this, but he, you know, looked for both dangling files and unpacked pack files. And I'm sure, you know, most of our listeners are familiar with Git. But there are ways in which you can leave previously like scrubbed commits in the history, and it's non-trivial to go through this. I don't know, Justin, if you've ever went down this path before. I did this for Elastic back in the day, and they have so many repos and they're so huge, and the history makes them even larger. I mean, you really do need like terabytes to be able to actually pull these down, and then
you'll run out of disk space
very quickly. Yeah, so the way that he did this was like really cool and really smart, but you know, he recommends how Git internally works, but then he specifically iterated over a bunch of programs that he's in, and then specifically went through the actual Git commit history, which I think is really powerful. And and then kind of, I think, just went deeper than anyone else has before and at a scale that people haven't before. And then specifically, you want to recover deleted files. And then, you know, if they don't delete it in a very specific way, it's still exposed. Like, you're still able to get it through Git, through the history. And so anyways, that's what he did. You can read it. It's very interesting. I'm sure they're still low-hanging fruit, especially amongst a lot of private programs. Like, he's not in every possible private program on the planet, right? And then he's all, and maybe he is on all the private programs on like one platform, but there's many bug bounty platforms. So you could literally just replicate what he did for only your private programs. It would use less disk space than doing all the public ones. And then you also wouldn't dupe with him on a bunch of these. I think that'd be a really valuable and high quality way to hack. So,
well, one of the things he said in here, which was really interesting, was that these, so what happens in Git when you, you know, remove something is that it becomes sort of unlinked. The file is still there, right? And it, but it becomes unlinked to the specific commit, right? And what he said is that it stays in the GitHub repo for like 2 weeks or something like that. I'm trying to, let me see if I can find the actual, because I know that they are typically retained for around 2 weeks before being eligible for garbage collection, the deleted files. And so this is something that we need to be looking at, you know, over time. And unless you said they do like this whole rebase and like restart the whole Git repo, then the deleted files are still going to be there. And this is something, man, you know, I did this back in the day.
Right.
I did this, you know, a long time ago. I had a full automation for this. Tom Nom Nom was the first guy that introduced me to this back in like 2018. Mm-hmm. But these things come in cycles, you know, you know, Sharon just got the latest cycle of it, which is cool.
I will say one thing was cool, the way he used AI to like find more repos. Like, I think this is like the fact that these tools are, you know, basically free or really cheap, and then they'll do a bunch of research for you on your behalf. I think it's still being underutilized. Obviously, I talk a lot about AI, but I think that specifically things like O3 and like deep research on Gemini and stuff like it can find a lot of information very quickly, because obviously it's not getting tripped up by captchas, because they're either using indexes or they've got, you know, working relationships with the providers. So they're able to mine data really well for things like this. Actually, that'd be a good transition into the tool I made, because I threw OpenAI into it recently. Did you see that change?
Yeah, good. Well, hold on. Before we jump to that, here, I'll share my screen since you can get the next one ready. But I wanted to say one more thing that was really cool about this research, which is he just used Truffle Hog for all this. So it's not like he's grepping for like a super secret list of API keys, which is really cool. And then, but he said, you know, these are the secrets that caused the most impact. And at the top of the list was GCP project and AWS production tokens. So definitely, you know, we got to keep an, and then he shows one right here of like a Google service account. And so we really got to keep our eyes open for these. And then the other shout out was that he said a lot of times what happened was people would just commit binary files such as PYC files, right? And not realizing, because that's a binary file, you know, they're looking at it and they're like, oh, okay, that doesn't have anything insensitive in it. That it definitely does.
It's like a code review bypass kind of path.
Yeah, I mean, you can decompile those things a lot of times, and the strings are just going to be in there. And I remember at a live hacking event back in the day, I saw a finding that was just like super, super good and won best bug of the event, where the guy found it exactly in the same way, that where somebody had committed a certificate to log into a GitHub, you know, organization. Inside of a like binary SQL file. And no one had found it, but then as he was grepping through it, he stumbled upon it, was able to extract the cert and auth into the hosted GitHub, and it was like, it was really bad. So this is definitely a big thing. Paying extra attention to binary files is important. Make sure you add that dash A on your rip grep or your grep if you're grepping across stuff.
Yeah, I still, like you said, because of Tom Nom Nom, do like grep dash HRNIA or whatever, like anytime I'm grepping, just because of those initial videos from him and Stoke and stuff like that. So very cool. So I wanted to roll that into the tool that I released. It doesn't make sense for a good share. Do you want to talk about it?
Me too. pop up a bunch of tech. Yeah, I mean, I just, and it's funny because it was on my list, not your list.
Right.
but it's essentially, you know, you release this tool where it's just a really simple website tool where you just go in there, you put in a domain, and it pops up like 15 pop-ups in your browser.
Yep.
That are like, hey, here's Google, GitHub, Wayback Machine, Shodan's, Security Trails, CertSH, ChatGPT, Census, all of these, you know, places where you would normally scrape data. And oftentimes people have like scripts for all that, but you just kind of did it right in the browser, which I think has a sort of attractive, quick and dirty nature to it, right? Where it's like, okay, you know, I'm not necessarily at my setup right now, but I kind of want to do some preliminary recon on this thing. Let me just drop this domain in here and, you know, make sure I'm not missing any of these places where I could find additional assets.
Yeah, for me personally, it's like when I'm hacking and I'm like in a JavaScript file and I find a random dev subdomain, that's when I would use something like this. It's like, I'll just throw this in here because it's so useful for it to pop up like in a GitHub search, because then it's like usually in one of their repos or one of their employees, right? So it comes up in that GitHub search, and then just kind of having all of the rest of that pop up at the same time is really useful. I did notice a lot of people were like, all this does is open Google. It's like, yeah, it is actually confusing. So when I ran this tool the first time on my computer, I got a pop-up that was like, do you want to open more pop-ups? And I was able to just approve it. But then HackLuke, me and him were hanging out and talking and stuff, and he cloned it onto his website. And so I went and used it on his website. It didn't give me that pop-up. I had to manually go into Chrome, :// settings, and like browse for his website and then go enable it. So if you try to use this tool, like make sure you enable pop-ups so that they all appear. And you know, you can just look at the source of this page and make your own copy. You don't have to use mine. But I think it's just a really nice way to pull up all of the different like kind of Google dorks. And someone could also clone this tool and make it do a bunch of Google dorks. The issue is because it's coming from one IP and one user agent, you will get those really annoying captures at some point.
Yeah, well, it worked for me too. You know, the first time I just, you know, put in a domain and I pressed launch and it popped up one. But then if you go back to the actual, you know, your website, it'll say, allow this website to pop up multiple pop-ups. And I pressed allow and ran it again and it went it like popped all of them out.
Cool.
So I think it's most people that have an interest in using this tool can figure out how to actually use it.
Yeah, that's fair.
So helpful, I think. So good job there, man.
Cool. Yeah, no problem. I love those little like tiny tools.
All right. Let's see.
I have a really small one since that one was technically on your list. There's a very small group of listeners that like care a lot about local models. They're probably, you know, some of the most privacy and security conscious. And I love, you know, following the AI space. Simon Willison mentioned that the new Qwen 3, especially the 8-bit model, even at 4-bit quantized, but even at full size, it still can run on most MacBook Pros or on like most GPUs. Like if you have a gaming computer, right, that you hack from or whatever, you can run it too. And so anyways, I was going to recommend that. It seems like it's the best at that model size, and 8 billion parameters is small enough where, especially at 4-bit quantized, you can run it with 16 gigabytes of RAM. So if you have like an old M1 or M2 and it's only got 16 gig of RAM, you can run this pretty efficiently on like your little commuter laptop. And I think, you know, a lot of people are like, well, what would you do with it? I think there are a lot of like kind of interesting, you know, write for me or summarize this tasks that, like, let's say you have 1,000 URLs that you want it to like, that, you know, you can like curl the request, or you can curl the JavaScript or whatever, and then just return that to the local model and just say, describe this. And you go to sleep and you have to do that across all of them. Like a lot of like overnight running tasks where you don't want to buy the token cost. You can use these kind of local models for.
Well, and I think there's a privacy piece of that too, that, right, where one of the things that Jason said when he came on the podcast last time was that you can use these local models for simply for redaction. So you know, you say, okay, hey, here's an HTTP request, redact any identifying factors on this, right? And then you send the redacted API or, you know, request to, you know, a state of the art model,
right?
And then it can do its thing, right? Without knowing what target you're on and that sort of thing. So I think that's valid. And then I think also, you know, like we have for Shift, dude, for Shift, it's not sending your data to the AI unless you specifically ask it to, right? The only exception to that is when you turn on AI rename for your tabs, for your replay tabs within Kaito. And then it sends every, you know, replay request that you have out to to the AI. And I was thinking, it'd be really nice if we had something like a very small local model that could just look at our HTTP requests and do the thing that we tell it to do. Right. Like, hey, rename this
tab. It's so low stakes. It's like, who cares if it's wrong? Who cares if whatever?
Yeah. I mean, if it makes small mistakes, it's not the end of the world. Right. It's just better, you know, to have the things renamed the way we want them renamed.
Right.
So I think this could be a really good use case for this too.
Yeah. If people have like little tiny tools they want to run locally that do small tasks like that, it's a great idea.
Actually, in the tweet, Simon said that it only uses 4 to 5 gigabytes of RAM while it's running.
Well, that's because he's using the full bit, 4-bit quantize. And then also, you never wanted to use all of your RAM. So that's why I said it's perfect if you have like 16 gig of RAM, because Chrome's going to take up 8, you know, and then and most people don't want to close everything down to run their AI model. So yeah, that's what's great about it, is that it only uses that much. Yep.
I have 16 gigabytes of RAM, open Chrome. You have 4 gigabytes of RAM.
Exactly, Matt, you can use the AI.
Yeah. All right, man. So next up, I guess I'll take this next one.
Yeah.
There is an article released entitled "May Cause Pwnage." This is on I'm gonna butcher this guy's name, but Jaisal.
Jaisal, yeah, sounds right.
Jaisal, yeah, sounds about right. On his blog, and it was in collaboration with Jorian, who's very active in the CTPB community. And essentially, this is an audit of MCP protocols and some kind of vulnerabilities that have been happening in them. And it's definitely a good read for any of you guys that are interested in sort of getting ahead of this curve on AI adoption. So as these companies start implementing MCP protocol for their various utilities, then this is something we're going to have to be on the lookout for. And it's often running on non-standard ports. And it, you can see right here, man, like one of the first things that on the list is get-based CSERF to command injection. And I'm like, oh no.
Yep.
And it's crazy how simple this exploit is. It's like literally slash SSE, transport type is stdio, and then command equals calc.exe, and it just pops calc.
Yep.
And I'm like, no. So very impactful stuff here. They cover how to do DNS rebinding to attack this environment and extract data, and a bunch of other vulnerabilities where they sort of scanned across the internet to try to identify these MCP servers and got a lot of, I think it was like 104 command and control servers that could have been stood up across the whole internet. So definitely some good research here.
Yeah, and what's insane is like, you know, when we had mentioned MCP security being an issue, you know, because if you have multiple tools and there's like some sort of prompt injection in one, then it can like execute in the other. Like for that calc.exe, for example, right? If that was chained with something else that was browsing the web and you have prompt injection on your site that says, hey, pop this command, then the one that does the command exec can actually pop it, right? But these bugs are just in the protocol, like, and in the implementation. Like, these aren't even using prompt injection in any way, shape, or form, right? So I think MCP is like a really, really great spot for people to dig in and research, like you said, because companies are going to be releasing them. I've met with a few startups that are already implementing them, and some of them have already released them. These are not companies that I know of that have bug bounty programs yet, but like, it's coming. So especially if people didn't know this, OpenAI and Google have both agreed to use MCP. It's obviously, it was like released and invented by Anthropic, but like the other providers have accepted it. So by leaning into it, you're not, you know, only doing research on a thin slice or something. You're doing research on something, on a protocol that's going to be used by everyone.
So help me understand the use case of this a little bit, because I'm still a little bit of fuzzy. This is enabling the AI to execute tools on a specific service provider. Is that right? Now, is that typically like an API? So like, you know, whatever, seats.arrow, you know, exposes an MCP server, and now the AI can interact directly with seats.arrow? Or
yes, perfect. Is it something that's exactly right. Yeah, so many people are like, MCP is just an API. It's like, yeah, you're not wrong, but at the same time, it's really important, because like, let's say that you're seats.arrow and you want to expose your API. Do you want every developer and every AI client to have to re-implement your tool call, right? Or even if you have like a GitHub repo they can go clone from and add, or like something they can go copy and paste into their code, they support it. It just is still too abstract, right? So MCP streamlines that, where basically you stand up the MCP server. Now, any MCP client, of which there are not a lot yet, but of which there are becoming more and more. So like WindSurf, Cursor, and like the Claude desktop app are like the most used by far. in those MCP clients, you can just put in your MCP config, the tools you want it to have exposed, and that there's still a lot of ambiguity there and implementation details that are not ironed out fully. Like some people are doing it different ways, but basically you just add the tool to your MCP client's config. And now you don't have to worry about implementing the documentation or explaining to your AI how to write the query or naming the tool and all those things. It was done by the MCP server and author basically. And so then now any client can connect to that server.
Nice. Yeah. So I imagine this is one of the things that we'll also see, you know, for the recon boys out there, you might want to put some stuff in there where you start fingerprinting these things as they spin up, because I imagine what'll happen is like, there'll be some, server that is exposed, some internal server, right? That was supposed to be internal, but it's external and it's exposing MCP so that, other, you know, pieces of AI in the organization right, can reach out to this thing and interact with it. And then, but if that's actually exposed to the internet, then boom, you know, you're in big trouble. Sort of situation.
And honestly, you won't know when those are changed under the hood because you're not going to want to push updates to the clients or anything. So you may even want to, like, when you said fingerprint, I thought you were going to say like fingerprint how they're responding. Like if they have like version numbers, like, you know, maybe the MCP server has a version call, or if not, basically retesting is going to be really valuable here, because if they mess up auth, where let's say they implemented OAuth or something where you're only supposed to have access to your data. If you like ask the MCP server to give you someone else's data, it's not going to work at first. But if they have a regression or they implement a bug down the road or something, then you would catch that if you're retesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine the MCP server has to have some sort of introspection, right? To be able to tell the AI, you know, hey, these are the tools that
it has to have like notes like, hey, here's how you format your request. And then that gets used in the context. Yeah.
So it should be super easy to sort of monitor change logs, so to speak, on what functions are being exposed by the MCP servers.
Well, whatever ones they disclose to you, what's interesting is that a lot of these on the back end will probably have other API routes created, but then not in the notes, like not in the tool notes that get passed to the AI. So if you can actually just like, there's probably some fun exploration and deep research, which isn't as scannable, but where you can go in and be like, hey, let's just see if there's any other routes. Just try this route or try this route or try this path traversal or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're looking at the rest of the vulnerabilities in this write-up, there's like, you know, SSRF, local file disclosure, more RCE, you know, Git command injection. Yeah. It's like, there's a ton of stuff in here.
Yeah.
So, definitely a ripe environment both for recon boys and for, the rest of us.
Yep.
All right. So that's that. Let's go ahead and bump down, to your next one. Okay. So, by the way, you had this on here, the no XSS, WAF bypass or whatever.
Yeah.
Dude, like this, okay, sure. Maybe this is a WAF bypass. Like this got like 1,000 likes on it, but import is like the most standard way to like load an external resource.
I just thought it was like, I just thought it was hilarious. And I was like, you know, people want things to try. And so it's awesome to have something to try. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is, for me, you know, this is like the go-to way to
your bread and
import
butter.
A script. Yeah, nice. This is like try a script tag when you're doing XSS sort of situation.
Yeah.
But it is definitely good to be aware of. And some hackers that I've seen recently didn't know that you could dynamically import JavaScript, you know, without having to create a script tag or like fetch the data and then, you know, eval it or something like that via the import function call. So it's a good call.
Yeah, I mean, I've never used the import function call, so maybe that's why it was like super interesting. I threw it in there.
But,
yeah.
Well, there's lots of data to, there's lots of, you know, ways to smuggle data through. So that's a good one. All right, dude, let me show you this. Now I'm gonna flex a little bit. Dude, we're recording this on May 7th, right? This is gonna be released May 8th.
Yep.
Thank you, production team. And I have not pushed this plugin to the Kaito store yet, and I'm going to do that tonight.
I'm sure you will.
So hopefully it'll be released by the time that this podcast airs. But I'm creating a new plugin called Drop, okay, for Kaito, and it is super helpful for sharing various objects from person to person. So let's say, you know, so I'm going to show you how it works right here. You open up Drop, and it gives you a share code right here, right? And then you pass that share code to your friend, And this is your PGP public key right here. Everything is end-to-end encrypted for this. And once you give your friend, you know, your public key, then your friend can encrypt data with your public key, chuck it up to the server, and then you sign something, you know, saying, hey, I have the private key for this public key.
Yeah, yeah.
Give me all the messages for this public key. You download that message, decrypt it with the private key, and then you you know, ingest these specific objects into your Kaido instance after you have a chance to assess them. And so you can get messages. Hopefully, I'm going to try to do a live demo right now. We'll see if it works.
Let's see what happens. So,
scope dropped to Justin Gardner, right? And then you get a notification saying, hey, you got a drop from Justin Gardner. Here's the scope. Would you like to claim it? You press claim. And now, you know, you've got another scope right here in your Kaido environment.
Cool.
So we can right now we can share filters, scopes, match and replace, and replay tabs.
Dude, match and replace is going to be a really clutch one. A lot of times when I'm collaborating with other people, they'll be like, oh, I figured it out. I got the match and replace work on the client side so that I can like see all the routes, you know, or whatever. And being able to like immediately share, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So it should be super great for collaboration.
I feel like this is, we talked about this, right? This is like called like the Kieran callbacks. We'll call that section. Didn't Kieran make a Justin Nerd Sniper plugin like a year ago or something for Kaido that was like Nerd Snipe Justin, but I think it used Discord webhooks. This is much more, this is much more collaborative, send back and forth, but this reminds me very strongly of that.
Yeah. You know, and you can hook into a, like a specific webhook to like dump it in a channel or something, but I wanted something that just allows me to send it to your Kaido instance directly. You know, so if we're collaborating, you literally just have a message pop up that says claim, you know, or like
that's
new
so
drop
cool.
from Justin, here's this request, and you have claim or delete, right? You press claim and boom, it's in your replay, you know, and you can just, you know, tweak it. And stuff
I don't want to do bugs or anything. Like if my Kaido's closed and you've sent like 12 and I open it up, will they be sitting there waiting?
They will. Yeah. They sit on the server for 7 days.
Yep.
Unless they're claimed, right? And if they're claimed, they're stored locally in your Kaido. But after 7 days, they're gone. So if your homie is just not collabing with you at all and you're spamming your homie, then it's, you know, it's not going to fly.
Is there anything besides the pop-up? Like, does it also show up in the drop tab or something?
Yeah. Okay, Hold on. Let me show you one more time as well. Cause there's a little pop-up that will pop up on the screen, right? So if we go right here, I drop to myself, right? There's this little pop-up that pops up at the right-hand corner. Let's see. There it is right here. Right.
Cool.
But I can close this, right? Say, okay, I don't want to address that right now. And I can go to drop and go to received messages.
Oh, okay, perfect.
And here's the message right here. And then you can claim or delete.
Dude, such a cool plugin idea.
Yeah,
I
think this will be great. I also want to develop something where even without knowing your public key, I can create like a link that says, hey, here's like this request, right? Mm. And it just encrypts it. And then maybe passes you the shared secret or whatever via a hash in a URL or something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you put that link into Kaido, it will download the specific request, decrypt the, you know, encrypted data, and then give you an opportunity to claim that.
Dude, that's
object,
cool.
Whatever
that's really
is.
Cool.
Yeah. I really want the Kaido, you know, I want this to be a really collaboration rich environment.
Yeah.
And I think that will help with it a lot.
Yeah, this is going to be awesome. I can't wait to use it.
Yeah. So hopefully this will be on the Kaido store by tonight. I am still running it on my local dev server, but I have some time allocated later today to get everything pushed to prod. And it'll be out there.
Cool. I'm going to jump to Andre's.
Sure.
Just in general, I think Andre's been killing it lately.
Yeah,
on
he's been pushing out good content.
He has been. The question is whether it's him or Hack Luke, but one thing that's really great about this is like the little things that he's been posting is that I feel like it's a bunch of stuff, to be honest, that feels like it's in this vein of like really cool research or really cool techniques that people haven't really, or at least that I personally haven't incorporated into my testing flow like strongly. And like, you know, a good example, is like the smuggled, like, what are these called again?
Encoded word.
And yeah, basically encoded words. I never check for this, which in general, I think it's kind of hard to test for things that you have to like redo the full sign up flow for each time, which, you know, maybe this one you don't, you know, you can go in and like change your email on a lot of apps, but anytime there is a, you know, like kind of a bug or like a testing thing that happens as a result of like what you do during sign up and you have to like go confirm your account and all that, I'm like kind of lazy with that in the past. And I think that I'm going to change that now and like kind of lean into testing more stuff like this. I don't know. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
It's pivotal to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Like, the amount of times that I've gone to a live hacking event and I've been busting my ass, like to configure all of these things and find these really obscure crits. And then Andre just walks in and he's like, yeah, I threw this like weird Unicode character
exactly.
in there and now I've got arbitrary ATO and I'm like, screw you, dude.
Oh,
like,
seriously though. Like,
it's too real. And somehow Andre always finds arbitrary ATO via like this email related garbage. And I'm like, how do you do this?
Well, I wonder if he does basically like objective-based hacking. I don't know. I'm sure you've discussed that on the pod.
For sure.
We've discussed that on the pod before, but I talk a lot about that with Douglas and Kieran. Is like, sometimes when you're constrained, especially a life hacking event with like a hardened target, if you just set like a really hardcore goal and then just aggressively pursue that, the constraint breeds creativity in like your things that you're attempting.
Yeah, 100%. And man, I've done this a couple times in live hacking events and I've gotten them every time.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow, this is nuts.
Yeah.
See, like if I really just lock in on like, you know, one thing, I'm thinking of a specific live hacking event in particular where I was surprised, where I was like, okay, my goal is to do creepy shit with this app, you know? And
is that
and
in London?
There was one in London and then there was also one in Vegas as well. I was like, this is what I want to accomplish. You know, and then somehow it happened. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like maybe everything is possible. You just gotta keep poking at it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, Andre is nuts, man, because I do remember one time where we were at a life hacking event and the team set out a challenge and we were all like, haha, that's cute. Like they're putting 100K bounty on this day or like 70K bounty.
Yes, and it's impossible.
Yeah. And it's impossible. And then Andre's like found it like less than 24 hours after the challenge was released. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And it was like a 15-year-old bug too. It was crazy.
Wow.
It was crazy.
That's awesome.
All right. Last thing on the list for me was, NahumCon is just around the corner, man. And we haven't shouted it out on the pod yet. So if any of you guys are not aware, our boy NahumSec, Ben, does this conference every year that is just very much bug bounty relevant. And this year they've got AI related stuff and you've got bug bounty related stuff. You know, you might see your boy hosting, who knows? You might see your boy Rezo giving a presentation. So definitely want to check that out. You can find it at nahumcon.com. I'm just going to read some of these titles
dates?
Out here.
Yeah.
You grab the dates. I believe it's the 22nd and the 23rd.
May 22nd, 23rd.
And so here's the first day schedule. Okay. You got the keynote by, Jay Haddix, Rezo, NahumSec. You got, XSS Doctor, doing a talk on AI assisted hacking. You got Wonder Wuzzy, another, person that came on the pod talking about advanced prompt injection exploits in LLM apps. You've got your boy Rezo again, AI findings in bug bounty. You got Monke, another, pod veteran, talking about, hacking how we learn speed running bug bounty proficiency with AI. You got Jay Haddix on modern AI assessment and you got Daniel Miesler with AI capabilities for attackers and defenders. What a stacked lineup, dude.
Yep.
That is crazy. So definitely going to be tuning into that.
That's just AI day. Day two is Tom Nom Nom, J-Rock, Insider PhD.
Oh my gosh.
Renee Pack, Armand Samir. Yep.
Yeah, dude.
Tom
so
Anthony.
Many of these people are have come on the pod too. It's great.
I mean, the community's tight, right? So,
yeah, it is. It is. So definitely check it out. Day two also looks awesome. You've got GraphQL stuff. You've got cookie counterfeiting. You've got Tom Nom Nom. Whenever Tom Nom Nom puts anything out, you should definitely check that out.
1000%.
Yeah, and then I think one of the most underestimated hackers out there is Brumans, dude. Like this guy puts out some really, really good vulns and all of his stuff that he does for Yes We Hack as well is like super high.
Top notch. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely something to check out.
Last thing I wanted to cover was this Pliny thing. That's obviously AI related. Basically, Pliny, who we've talked about a lot, does a lot of jailbreaking and AI hacking and stuff. He shared the like system prompt leak for Gemini 2 Pro with Canvas. And it, one, it's just interesting and good to read. But two, somebody, maybe the other person on this recording right now, has found some good bugs in Gemini Pro Canvas. So the Canvas is like a really interesting thing to hack, right? Because it's like basically like a little mini compiler, or like not really compiler, but it basically can like execute the code that Gemini.
Yeah, it's a code execution environment built into the LLMs. Yeah,
right. And it has so many little weird nuances and quirks. And it's in, even in AI Studio, there's also now like these like starter apps that are kind of in there. And so I think that where's I going with that?
Did you see the tweet by Logan as well that was close to this, where they just listed out like all of the freaking Google employees that were building really cool shit in Canvas on like one-shot prompts? Like, this thing is pretty powerful.
So yeah, it's really powerful. I mean, people should use it. I think in general, and I actually gave you this tip, Justin, so I'll go ahead and give it to listeners, and it worked really well for you.
Sick. Yeah. Mm.
If you're building things with AI, and it feels like such a like a silly or trivial tip, but it works extremely well. Basically, if you're using AI to like write some code for you, instead of giving it, you know, a vague description of what you want, or even a 70% description of what you want, that 30%, when the AI is in there modifying like multiple files and stuff, will basically mean you loop a lot and you end up with a lot of little bugs that you then have to work through over time. If you can get your spec, like your description of what you want, to more
what
like
you call it, the product requirement document, PRD?
Yeah, PRD. Like if you can get a perfect, or like a verbose product requirement document that's like 90 to 100% of what you want, the new AI models, and I haven't even used the new Gemini Pro model that came out yesterday that's even better at coding, will basically one-shot your idea, even if it's across multiple files or whatever. So the tip here, and like anytime you hear a person who's at the bleeding edge of tech say something, which in this case was Andre Kaparthy that I saw, and then another guy that I love, it's probably the best AI engineer I know, his name is Hrishi. Like Hrishi was DMing me the same thing that Kaparthy had said, and he hadn't read what Kaparthy said. So basically these two guys converge on the same insight and wisdom, which is basically spend more time than you think you need to coming up with that product requirement document. And you can do it in Gemini 2 Canvas, which we just mentioned, right? So if you open Gemini and then you like enable the Canvas tab, just say like, hey, I want to build this app. Give me a PRD. You know, it'll know what it is for that thing so that I can read it and refine it. And then as you're reading it, you'll see things where it's ambiguous. Like it'll be like, it'll just say like back end tech stack. And you'll say, no, I want the back end to use specifically this tech stack, you know, and I want it to work in this specific way. Anyways, just iterate on that a few times and then give that PRD to an AI model to build it. And you're going to get a much higher quality thing. Yeah, but anyways, dude, I want to bring it out.
Well, you go ahead. Let me just say on that as well, dude. Two things. One of the biggest takeaways from the Google Live Hacking event that we did was Gemini is freaking awesome.
Oh, it's amazing.
It is an amazing, amazing, amazing AI tool. So don't sleep on Gemini just in, you know, efficiency of life sort of things.
Yep.
And two, just to support what you said, drop the kind of plugin that I was just telling you about for collaboration. It's got a bunch of, you know, it's got end-to-end encryption. It's got, you know, some custom UI components that interact with Kaido. I spent a long time doing what you said. I went to Gemini. I said, hey, let's build a PRD for this. Here are the specs. Here's what I want it to do.
Yes.
Here's the back-end component. Here's the front-end component. And it completely one-shotted the back-end component.
Yeah.
Like, so I probably tweaked
listeners,
5 lines.
If you have an idea for Kaido plugin, do what Justin just did. Do what he just said. Do a PRD. Give it the context of how Kaido plugins work, like the, you know, the repo or whatever, the README, and then it will potentially one-shot the entire solution.
Yeah, and the UI it generated was amazing. And and the front end I had to tweak a bunch because I was like hooking into Kaido UI and like all sorts of stuff like that. But the back end, it completely one-shotted.
Yep.
I'm like, this is crazy.
Yeah, it's really cool. Nuts. It's super cool. So anyways, where I was going with the mentioning the Canvas is not just the fact that the Canvas is there and that you can get the system prompt from that link that we'll put in the show notes, but there are just like so many other little AI features that Google's adding across the board. You know, we're passionate about like hacking on them and stuff. They just added Gems in Workspace. And so anyways, lots of cool stuff to hack on. I just wanted to give that to listeners so they had something to, you know, go hack on this week if they didn't have anything to look at.
Yeah, 100%. Very cool stuff. We've got like 2 minutes, so I'm going to cover this last thing really quickly from Gareth Hayes that was actually in your docket here. But Gareth tweeted something out, and this is like, I think, just a perfect example of what we talk about when we're saying, hey, just like tell the community about cool shit.
Yes.
Right? So that we can all understand better how this cluster of JavaScript works, man. It's amazing. And so Gareth tweeted out, I think it was around April 25th earlier, and said, hey, there's something really weird with SVG related onload handlers. And there's this, when you console.log the actual onload handler from an SVG onload onclick event, you know, or what is that? Event handler attribute in HTML. That's what I'm trying to say. Then it looks very different or very slightly different from what you would see when you look at an image tag onload or on error handler. Mm-hmm. The difference is that there is a different event parameter that is being passed. One is event and the other one is EVT. And he was speculating on why that's the case. But the TLDR of the situation is that it actually provides a way for you to get a DOM reference inside of that onload handler. So you can do evt.composedPath.pop.defaultView.alert1, right? So that default view gives you the document reference, and then alert one, you know, or default view gives you the window, and then you can run alert one on that. And he shouted this out, and I think it's relevant for anybody who that likes JavaScript-based sandboxes. If you have a sandbox, you've got to look out for this, because this can result in a DOM object leak, which can be really impactful in those sandbox scenarios. So if you find yourself stuck in a sandbox and you can't get a reference to the document, then you might be able to use an SVG onload event to, you know, go down that path that Gareth described here and get a reference to the document object.
Yeah, I'm... you know, not a very strong JavaScript person, but like when I was reading this and I saw that EVT pop up with like that conversion, I'm just like, what are they doing?
It's weird.
It's so weird.
Yeah. So. And he says, I suspect that this is a workaround to accommodate IE quirks, because there's a global window.event. So there's like some namespace conflicts, you know, that sort of thing. So definitely a cool thing to note by Gareth here. And he says, and I'll just read this line at the end. It says, there isn't really a conclusion to this, and I'm just happy to blog things about things that I find interesting. In any way, I hope you enjoyed it. Which is just, yes.
Please, Gareth, do that for everything. Everyone, please do that. But yes, thank you.
We give him a round of applause.
Yes.
Teach us more about this crazy land of JavaScript.
Right.
We want to know everything so that we can understand how to break it.
Right.
And I think that's the pod. Am I right?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Thank you all for listening. Good work. Sorry, the Google episode is not out. And I've also recorded the second part of the AI series. So that'll either, if Google's not ready next week, they can come out next week. If not, it'll be the week after. So.
Yeah. All right. GG, guys.
See ya.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for watching to the end, y'all. If you want more Critical Thinking content, or if you want to support the show, head over to ctbb.show/discord. You can hop in the community. There's lots of great high-level hacking discussion happening there, on top of masterclasses, hackalongs, exclusive content, and a full-time hunter's guild if you're a full-time hunter. It's a great time. Trust me. All right, I'll see you there.